Back in My Play returns, not 4 days since the last episode. That was with Mike Mica, another fantastic discussion. I always have an absolute blast whenever I talk with Mike. Hope you guys enjoyed that one. But I got another one this week, this time with Chris Kohler of course, Wire.com, of Retronauts, and Good Job Brain. It was great to finally talk with Chris because I've really followed his stuff ever since, you know, he was back on Retronauts in 2006 and following his stuff on Wired. He even helped recommend my very first Japanese curry place on my original trip to Japan a couple years ago. So it was really cool to talk with him. Just some really interesting discussions on where retro video games are at, talking about some potential price bubbles, you know, the impact of reproductions, of course, the NES Classic Edition, where Nintendo is going, just lots of great stuff coming up. And I also want to let you guys know, if you haven't checked it out this week, Retronauts has an outstanding episode on, you know, the Wii Virtual Console, because the Wii, and I should say Wii U, and just the 3DS Virtual Console, all those in general, talking about, you know, how it's been a really rough ride for VC, and they were looking back on you know, where it's gone or where it has gone and where it could potentially be going. But really go and check that out at Retronauts. USGamer.net is where you can, you know, jump on there and you can stream it, or you can follow them. Just search for Retronauts on the internet. You'll track that down. Really great episode with Chris and with Jeremy Parrish and Bob Mackey. Go and give it a listen. But aside from that, I just want to mention a couple of things before we get going. First, I've relaunched the final Back of My Play Teespring campaign for 2016. So these shirts will be ready in time for the holidays. So if you want to grab one for yourself or for a loved one, teespring.com/BIMP2016. That's like Back of My Play 2016. So teespring.com/BIMP2016. And you can get those shirts. I set them at a super low price. So I think they kick back like a dollar or two back to the podcast, but I really just want you guys to have these shirts. It's a great logo created by Lloyd Parker, and these t-shirts always turn out great. I actually ordered two new ones for myself as well. Aside from that, I have the first part of a multi-part documentary about Toronto indie game developers. That's up at youtube.com/FitCastNetwork. It's 10 minutes long. I really hope you can go check it out. But very fascinating stories on how these guys got into video game development. I really hope you can go give that a look and give me some feedback after you give it a look. And then for people out there, I mention this from time to time, but it is super important for the people that are supporting the show through patreon.com/backinmyplay. Things get crazier and crazier, and as you can, you know, tell from time to time, my schedule is nuts, so it means a lot to have those Patreon supporters to help support the production of this show so I can really set aside the time, produce episodes for you guys that you're going to enjoy, and just it really means a lot to help support the time that it takes into doing all this stuff and supporting the websites and hosting and all that. So please, if you haven't already, patreon.com/backinmyplay if you can afford it. And, you know, we had some people drop off in the last couple of weeks. It'd mean a lot if you really value this podcast, if you really want to help keep it going forward. Please jump on there, you know, become a Patreon supporter. And that makes my day. Every time I see one of those emails where it's like, you know, so-and-so become a Patreon supporter at $2 per episode, $1 per episode, whatever, that's like, oh man, that's, people get this. People really understand, you know what I believe makes this show so special. So thank you for all that. And finally, next episode, we will be covering a video game. We're going to be going back to that. It's been a while, but we're going to be talking about the sequel to a classic from the Nintendo Entertainment System and the Famicom. A game that's looked back on with some mixed. People have mixed emotions about this game. I think emotions is the right word, but that's going to be Castlevania II Simon's Quest. I'm going to be with Kurt Kalata and potentially a second guest as well. Stay tuned for all that coming up next week on Back of My Play. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. I'm going to stop talking because you're really going to love this interview with Chris Kohler. Chris is just absolutely outstanding. And again, I've mentioned a couple times, don't forget to check out his book, Power Up, available right now for about $10 on Amazon. Go give it a look. I loved it. I know you'll love it. Take care, guys. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello, welcome back to Back in My Play. My name is Kevin Larrabee, and it is a huge pleasure to have on the show someone that I followed for quite a long time, all the way back, not just on Retronauts, but also Wired on the Game Life blog, now Wired.com. That is Chris Kohler. Chris, how are you?
Hi, very good. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the compliments.
Well, it's great to
appreciate it.
Well, they're deserving because not only, and this is something that I need to attribute to you because we were kind of talking a little bit on Twitter, but I remember it was, it must have been like four or maybe even five. It was probably 4 years ago when I made my first trip to Tokyo. I was kind of where should I be going? And I know that you've been there a bunch. So I'm like, you know, Chris on Twitter, like, where should I go and get some dinner tonight? And you were saying, go curry.
Yes.
I found it. I locked it in. And now every time I go back there, it's like, it's hopefully not more than like two or three times a trip, but it's usually right when you get there, like getting into Shinjuku. There's one right by the hotel that I stay at.
Yep.
And you go there, you get some dinner. And then of course, on the way out, you got like an afternoon flight. Might as well get one more, you know, meal in before you go.
Yeah.
So I got to thank you for that. And of course, you know, when we get to talking about Power Up, like it's just been great, and I got to talk to Mike a little bit about this yesterday. Is like you and you know, of course, you know all the guys at Retronauts, you know Jeremy Parrish and you know Shane, like all you guys really helped start, like for a lot of us the idea of like, yeah, we should really be appreciating this history. We should be making sure that we are, you know, recognizing where all these games are coming from, the people that put them together, and now today it's, you know, even more so, and I think people out there are like really starting to appreciate it, not just on this like niche of like retro gamers and stuff.
Thank you. It's always really nice to hear and maybe feel like I had a small part in kind of getting that snowball rolling. Yeah.
You literally like wrote a book.
I did write a book.
And this is, again, something that was fun to kind of look back on as we were putting this together. But I remember, I think I was, at the time, I was interning at Game Trailers when I emailed you, because this is when I was like looking for some books. I was putting together like a video for like a school project for part of my internship, and I was looking for a copy of your book, and they were like sold out everywhere because it was kind of out of print, and copies were like $40, $50, $60, like if you could even find them. But now Power Up has been reprinted, and you added some content to the book as well. So it's going to be great for people that missed out on it the first time. They can get it right now.
Yeah, so it just came out October 19th, so just about a month ago, and it's finally back in print. Not only can you actually buy the book with the extra chapter that I wrote, but like it's available digitally. It's on Kindle, it's on iBooks, and all that good stuff. So you know, it's great because that's like the one thing people would always ask me for, and I'd be like, I can't help you. but fortunately enough, you know, I worked with a publisher that specializes in getting the rights back to books that have been where, you know, somebody sold the rights and they've gone out of print. So they had a legal team. They knew exactly what to do. We did it. And the fruits of that labor are now heavily discounted on Amazon. So you don't have to pay $50 anymore.
It's nuts. I mean, I think I got my copy for like $12, but I looked before we started recording. This is a great, you know, I guess pros and cons of book publishing today, where you can get, you know, such a book like this for $10 on Amazon.com and deliver it to your door for free, or get it on Kindle for the same price.
I'm very excited. Yes.
It's so
just
great.
More and more people can finally experience. Yeah.
Well, we're absolutely going to be talking more about the book, but I'm definitely going to be picking your brain on a couple different subjects. But for people, if you don't want to wait, hopefully you're just, you know, you pull over if you're in the car before you do it, but just, you know, you can go to Amazon, you're a Prime member, you can get it shipped to you free or get it on Kindle. There's a bunch of different ways to do it. Again, it's Power Up, How Japanese Video Games Gave the World an Extra Life. And like you mentioned, there's that extra chapter about Satoru Iwata, which is just fantastic to read, and just some great stories that you have in there. So even if you picked it up, you know, maybe 10 years ago, you can go pick it up again and get that extra chapter. And it's going to be a great gift for people this holidays if you have, you know, friends that are interested in video games. But again, I want to kind of pick your brain on a couple things, because not only there's a great ton of great content in the book. And I don't care where you're coming from. Like if you're listening to the show and you're just really into retro games, you think you know a lot about the history of video games, the incredible in-depth stories that you're able to get from going back into, you know, the history books and even some interviews that you've done over the years when you originally wrote it are incredibly in-depth. I'm kind of just curious. This was kind of like a unique opportunity for you, because you spent a lot of time in Japan, I believe when you were in school, but also you were able to speak a little bit of the language, so you're able to get some of these interviews that potentially other people wouldn't be able to have.
Yeah, for sure. Being able to speak Japanese, especially at the time. I mean, the funny thing is that, tons of people go and speak, you know, they take Japanese in college and they go to the Japanese game industry, and you have a lot of writers out there that can actually read, speak Japanese. But at the time it was kind of I was kind of a unicorn. And actually it really helped my career because, you know, a lot of publications that otherwise already kind of had their stable of freelance writers, you know, I was able to go to them and say, hey, I can review this RPG for you and actually talk about the story. I can actually like play through these games and give you a higher quality of review. And that actually really was very much a foot in the door to a lot of career opportunities. And yeah, Power Up obviously was a big one as well. I was on a Fulbright scholarship to write it. It's a U.S. government scholarship that sends, in my case, recent college graduates, but also like professors or grad students, things like that, out to foreign countries to do basically independent research. And I was like, not only am I going to write you a research paper, I'm not even going to do that. I'm going to write a book and we're going to sell this book. And they got very excited about that. It all came together very well. At the time, I didn't have a whole lot of contacts inside the video game industry, but I did my best to exploit what I could, and it worked out.
Yeah, and if you haven't picked up the book, it's, you know, not just talking about the history of these video games and the importance of Japanese video games on the industry as a whole, and it's, of course, its resurgence for helping, you know, the United States and North America, the Western part of the world, get out of the hole that, you know, the Atari 2600 and its preceding consoles kind of put us in. But just, you also are able to talk about things like, you know, if you're going to be going to Japan, and this is a great thing that you updated in there, and this is, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, because now if you are going to take a trip to Japan, a lot of people aren't really necessarily doing it to, they might go to the temples, they might check out, you know, some nice, the changing of the leaves right now here in the fall, but, you know, a lot of times they're going to be kind of making a beeline to Akihabara to go pick up some old games, and you know, rightfully so, needed to update that chapter because things have changed drastically.
Oh, big time. And when I first went there, and it was not in any way a tourist, it was not a tourist destination, but be really clear. I mean, if you wanted to go and buy Japanese like appliances or something like that, or, you know, the latest technologies, like, you know, maybe you would actually make a trip there, but it wasn't something that you did not go there to be entertained. Mm. It was, you could buy things there. Food options were limited in 2002. I went there in 2001 for the first time. You know, food options were very limited. It was fun if you really enjoy just ransacking stores for used video games, and that was about it. And then it all really started to change. Weirdly, after Power Up came up was when things really started rumbling. The Japanese government poured a whole bunch of money into a redevelopment district, and that's where you see all the sort of skyscrapers and office buildings and things like that. But also, it just became this hub of otaku culture, not just video games, but everything manga, anime, maid cafes, cat cafes, every sort of nerdy thing you can imagine kind of opened up shop in Akihabara. And now it's gotten to the point where Akihabara was listed one year higher than Tokyo Disneyland as a tourist destination that people wanted to go to. And this was all post Power Up. And so we were looking at, well, what should we add in to the book? Because we didn't want to make major changes to Power Up because then it wouldn't be Power Up anymore. But we put in an extra 2016 bonus thing about Akihabara, kind of talking about that and kind of, you know, now you can kind of compare and contrast like the original 2004 chapter about Akihabara, see what it was like then. It's not as, I mean, obviously, look, if you go to Tokyo, you want to buy old video games, duh, you're going to go to Akihabara. The stores are still there. But it used to be, you used to have to check like 20 different stores at least, because every Softmap store sold used video games going all the way back to the Famicom. There were the chain of stores called Liberty. There were like 8 of these stores in Akihabara, all within easy walking distance.
And those are gone, right?
The stores are still there, but Liberty has now, and I even checked with a guy. I was like, does anybody sell old video? Do any of your branches sell old video games anymore? He's like, no, it's all, they have almost entirely moved into selling figures, into selling toys yeah. And collectible figures and stuff like that. So the stores are still there, but there's no games in them anymore. The games have pretty much moved into, actually, and it is expanding a little bit, which is nice. The games have moved into basically five stores. There's Friends, which is this used to be secret one, right, that everybody always, you know, knows about now. There's Mandarake, which is the huge skyscraper tower, mm-hmm. That has all the nerd stuff. And their floor six is almost entirely devoted to video games. There's Super Potato, which is the one that everybody knows about. And there's a couple more. And there's actually a couple of new ones now, including Beep. Which is a store that's devoted almost entirely to classic Japanese computers. And this is a fascinating store on Akihabara because they have computers set up that are literally computer formats that unless you grew up in Japan in the 80s, like you've never seen one of these before running in your whole life. This is not compatible with the IBM or Commodore or anything. I mean, it's literally just like a unique Japanese PC format running software that was only built to run on these things. And they'll have them set up and you can look at them and you can buy incredibly expensive old PC games that somehow didn't get thrown away. So Akihabara is actually, it's getting a little bit better because I think that people are so interested in older video games now, and especially Japanese ones, that there's, you know, more places are kind of opening up, but the prices are just skyrocketing.
Yeah, that is, again, I think it was in you know, many parts due to the discussions that you've had elsewhere where, you know, I kind of knew when I went back, and again, this must have been in 2011, like I kind of knew the stores to go check out, whether it be, you know, Super Potato wasn't even as bad back then, but now it's like, you know, prices are jacked, but also it's kind of cleaned up there, like cleaned out, I should say. And
yeah.
You know, Friends is kind of where it's at. Friends and Mandrake are kind of like the two, you know, best places to go, but you go in a Trader, they still got that, you know, junk bin. You can still find a couple copies of, you know, Super Mario Brothers for 100 yen, 150 yen. Then
you got to go in. The first thing you always have to do in Akihabara, I'm going to give this secret away, is as soon as Trader opens in the morning, go in and go to the junk bin and kind of look at what they've dumped in there. I actually just got a copy. I mean, again, I didn't even realize that I'd find this, but I went into Trader and there was a copy of, you know, Mario and Wario, which is that SNES mouse game that only came out in Japan for you. It's like Lemmings, but with Mario. So they had one in there in the box. It just was missing the manual. So it was the mouse pad, the game, and the box, and the foam tray that came inside of it. And it was 400 yen. It was $4. And it was just like, it's missing the manual. I'm like, I don't care. It's great.
But that's the best part. I mean, I think that's why a lot of people, like gamers from the West, they're getting attracted to going and shopping over there because, you know, a scuff on the case of a CD-based game, and the CD could be perfect, a scuff on the case, junk, or like, you know, heavily discounted, and that is a great opportunity for you to pick some, you know, if you want to get like Donpachi and not spend $150, like you can go there and get a somewhat lightly scratched disc for significantly less.
Right. They will still, I mean, it's so funny because, obviously these stores, eBay does affect their prices. Like it would be impossible for it to not affect their prices because actually for a while, I mean, there were people who were really taking advantage of the fact that the eBay price for a game and the Akihabara price for a game were so far off that people would just go to Akihabara. And I saw multiple people there, even this last trip that I went on last year, just they had a basket. They have a list full of games, and they're just dumping games into the basket because they're gonna you know, turn and burn real fast on eBay. But Japanese stores will still give a heavy discount if there's some kind of a condition issue, and a lot of times that even if that game would sell for $100 on eBay, they'll still market $50 in their store. So you still gotta. It's just that you really have to look out now and. It's just a lot harder to go into Akihabara. You used to be able to go to Akihabara and be like, I want such and such a game. I want Darius Alpha for PC Engine. Like, I want it. And you'd be able to go in and find two stores that had it and you could buy it. But now it's like you might have a game in mind and it just might not be there.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Yeah, it's. I mean, at least it allows for some, you know, fun in the hunt, I guess. But you know, also involves some trips down to, you know, to go to oh God, what, I'm completely blanking, but the other, you know, strip mall with the other Mandrake that they're...
Oh, Nakano Broadway?
Nakano, yes.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's nice because it's a little bit removed from Akihabara, so slightly fewer people go there, but there's only the one good video. There's other places in there that sell video games. Actually, I did have some luck, not this year, but the year before. I mean, they, Nakano Broadway is full of those stores that have showcases. They're consignment shops. It's basically like you as a private person can rent a showcase, a little glass cube inside one of these stores that are full of these glass cubes, and put whatever stuff you want in there. And I had some luck looking in every single one of those to see if there were any video games in there, because those are going to be significantly cheaper because that's just a private person selling. But I also found there was a flea market in Akihabara, and there was a dude selling games there, and I was like, oh, I'm excited because what games is he selling? And all of his stuff was marked up so high, it was higher than the stores. Wow. And I bet you he was just able to like take the tourists who were kind of walking around, you know, for a ride on those prices.
Yeah, it's always worth looking if you're at Nakano Mall. Like, there's even like these weird kind of like used computer part shops where I found like, again, junk bin type Famicom disk system games without a case, but you know, they work perfectly. Sometimes they just have, you know, the game written on Sharpie because it was from those. That would be something I'd love to see, is those like Famicom disk system kiosks. Like, I've never seen one of those in person, but like that's one of those time machine things that I want to go back and, you know, that would be so rad to just walk into a Family Mart and be able to pick up a copy of, you know, Super Mario Brothers 2 on a disc.
Yeah, when I was still, you know, the first year that I lived there, you could still they called them the Nintendo Power kiosks, which had nothing to do with Nintendo Power magazine. But that was their branding for the kiosks that let you buy flash carts for the Super Famicom and the Game Boy, and you could buy games, some of them exclusively through those machines. They actually still had it there when I was first living there. Like Super Punch Out, the only way you can get Super Punch Out was to buy a flash cart and then dump it onto that.
Yeah, for some reason you can still buy those flash carts inside a Trader. Like, they'll still sell them to you, but they must be marking what games are on those flash carts, or are those blank?
They do mark what games are on the flashcards if there's any on there. Yeah.
Okay. We could talk about that forever, but let's go back to the United States, because it's very interesting right now with, you know, what's going on with the scarcity and the demand for the NES Classic Edition. Like,
oh yeah.
With again, you know, talking to Mikey yesterday with people, he went by a Target in Oakland and literally seeing, you know, lines of like 100 people outside the door getting there at 3 a.m. and still not getting one of these things on release date. So I'm kind of curious, you know, you wrote a great piece up in Wired, but I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, what does this mean? Does this mean like people just want this singular thing, or does this mean like, you know, Nintendo might really need to think about what they're going to do with the Switch in terms of the games that they're going to offer on there, in terms of like a virtual console games?
It's many questions.
Again, sorry.
I definitely think that Nintendo is finally tapping into a rich vein of nostalgia that they have not mined yet as a company, because I think that they looked at the, I'm sure that Nintendo looked at the Atari Flashback and similar systems like that and said, you know what, that's just not a business that we need to be in. I think that Nintendo now is like, we need to diversify our businesses, because maybe we do want to be in all of these different businesses because we need to make some money here. I think Nintendo is staring down a future in which, I mean, you know, people are excited about the Switch, I guess, but like, it doesn't mean that it's going to be a hit. And I mean, if it comes out and it's not a hit, if Nintendo wants to keep going, it's really got to have a lot of different revenue streams. And I think it finally kind of got it understood if it creates this really cool, you know, NES in a mini box, they're going to get consumers who don't buy other Nintendo products. I think a lot of the people who want this, they probably don't have a Wii U. They probably don't have a 3DS. And this is reaching consumers in a place where they want to be, which is a $60, you know, impulse buy that not only it's like, you can download Super Mario Brothers on your Wii U, but this really gives you the full experience. The controller is correct. And that controller, you know, Super Mario Brothers was designed for that controller. It wasn't designed for the Wii U gamepad. It's a close substitute, but it's not the real thing. And the video game is everything. A video game is not only the ones and zeros on the screen, but it's the tactile sensation of what you're holding in your hand. And so the NES Classic totally replicates this. And I think that really does appeal to people. And I think that the circumstances in which the NES Classic is appealing to people are not going to go away next year or the year after that or the year after that. The type of console, the generation of console may flip around, but I think there really is an ongoing nostalgia for Nintendo products that over the next 5 years Nintendo could really exploit if it is smart and if it understands what it's doing. And I've said, I mean, everybody's talking about the SNES Mini, the SNES Classic. They got to do a SNES version, which I think that they will. I think it'll be very easy for them to do that. I mean, it's literally it would be the same hardware that's inside the NES Classic, because that thing is a 4-core ARM, you know, processor. Like that can handle SNES emulation. So you just put it in a SNES shell, make a SNES controller, bing bang boom, which they already do because they've got the
exactly.
They're already doing it in Japan. And you're done. And then. But I think the actual huge product that Nintendo could make is a Game Boy Classic.
Totally.
I think that if they did that, and what I mean by that is you literally crawl to Hank Rogers at the Tetris company, crawl over broken glass if you have to get Game Boy Tetris on this thing, and then put Pokemon on it. And once you've done that, you're already off to the races, and I don't even care what other games you put on it, because it will be the best-selling Nintendo product of whatever year they release it, and if they do a Game Boy Classic. Like, my mom would buy that.
Yeah,
my mom
totally.
Does not purchase Nintendo products since Wii Fit. She would buy a Game Boy Classic and play Tetris on it, I guarantee you.
I buy two of them. This is kind of like a very similar discussion that Peter Brown and I were having, where it was like, if you kind of look at where technology is today, you could build that thing. You could build it for super cheap and get a really nice looking screen on there, and the battery life will be like 48 years.
I've got an Ardu Boy, you know, the Ardu Boy Kickstarted. I mean, that has a nice screen on it. I mean, Nintendo would have to put a backlight on this thing. They wouldn't want it to be like horrible. But like, that has a nice screen on it. It's super small. I mean, the Game Boy Classic itself would have to be bigger, because the Ardu Boy is really hard to hold. But it's like, you can do this little tiny portable game system that could totally run Game Boy games. You know, very cheap. I mean, they don't even have economy of scale, and they're only $50. So I mean, Nintendo, imagine what Nintendo could do. So yeah, I mean, they've just got to. And the problem is, of course, it's the classic, like, well, this is the obvious no-brainer. You'd have to be the biggest bonehead in the world to not do it. I give them about a 50% chance, because it's Nintendo. Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's why I wanted to ask you, is like, if you kind of look at, you know, you talk about, and I actually saw, it's a really cool mock-up of someone made like a Super Famicom Mini already like box, and you know what it could look like if that came out in Japan in the likes of the Famicom Mini. Do you actually think, like, are we going to wait 2 years for this, or is it going to be like Nintendo just has problems? And we've kind of seen in the past, like, they just sometimes have problems focusing on more than like maybe two things at once at max. Are they going to actually be able to do this? Or are we just going to continue to yell on our computers and it not happen?
So my understanding is that Nintendo Entertainment Research and Development, or NERD, in Europe are the ones who developed the NES Classic. So I really hope that Nintendo is just like, okay, congrats, you guys in Europe managed to, like, out of nowhere create our best holiday product in forever. You have a mandate to just keep going with this, and just let them do it. Like, you know, help them get the licenses for the software and oversee it, but just be like, okay, all right, Nintendo Europe, staff up. This is what you do now, and you will do this for us. I mean, that's what I hope would happen. And they just forget about it, and then every now and again, you know, NERD comes out and they're just like, we made another amazing thing for you. I'm like, okay, thanks. And then they just generate cash. I mean, geez. Nothing is so simple as they make it sound, but it's simpler than people think it is.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, we're talking today, it's literally 10 years to the day of the release of the Wii, which was their last, like, impossible to find, you know, piece of hardware. And who knows how long it's going to take for these things to actually, you know, show up on a shelf where you could walk into a store and just buy it and not have to, you know, show up at 3M like those poor people did at Target.
Yeah, I mean, the Wii was a special case because, I mean, I think that completely took everybody in the whole entire gaming industry by surprise. And not to mention the fact that when you look at it, I mean, people are like, oh, they're keeping them artificially scarce. It's like, man, they made more Wiis.
Exactly.
They manufactured more Wiis than anybody had ever manufactured of any video game console ever in the history of video games.
Like 100 million.
And I mean, and even at launch, like even like, you know, during the first year, they shipped more than anybody had ever shipped of a video game system. And so in that case, they were literally just in uncharted waters. You know what I mean? Nobody had ever gone there before and nobody had any idea what that was going to be like. Now, Amiibos, I don't know what their excuse is. Anybody I talked to about that was not within Nintendo was just like, I can't believe how few they made of these freaking things. That didn't make any sense.
Oh, and Nintendo never changed.
The NES Classic as well, I mean, I certainly hope that they've kind of learned from their mistakes because it really seems like they really undershipped this thing.
Well, if they see the response of this, like, can you imagine what people are going to do for a Super Nintendo Classic Edition? It's going to be nuts.
Commit murders. Well, the thing is, so here's my take on this. I think that Nintendo is generally a very conservative company to the point of almost being paranoid that they do not want to. Nintendo, I think, lives in fear of like overproducing something and being stuck with a bunch of stuff that they have to like discount. You know, they really hate that. But by the time the Super Nintendo one comes out, they will have actual data showing this is how many of the NES Classic we sold. And that means we're going to sell X number of Super NES Classic as well. And so hopefully they will be able to take that data and manufacture an appropriate amount of them. This was the risk. This was the, is this going to work or not? Yes, it definitely does. So next time you actually prep for it.
So do you think we go right to, if you know, in this magical world where they actually continue doing these, do we go to Super Nintendo or do they do like, you know, a remodel of the NES and do NES Mini or Classic Edition 2?
Oh, I don't know. I think that really is, again, like in this world where Nintendo understands what they're supposed to be doing, like that is probably... In my fantasy Nintendo, they're all having these discussions right now. You know what I mean? They're saying, okay, well, we have a lot of different options here. We can do NES Classic 2. We can do Game Boy Classic. We can do Super NES Classic. What are we going to do? How are we going to do it? I mean, at this point, they need to catch up with demand of NES Classic before they start manufacturing. But if they don't put out a new classic system for next year's holiday season, then I have no idea what they're doing. It should be something. I don't know what I would do. I'm not sure which one I would do. Honestly, I feel like I would lead with Game Boy. I feel like I would lead with Game Boy Classic because that one is just going to be so big. And like now is the moment to strike. The iron is hot. The Pokemon Go is still big. You lead with putting the Pokemon games on this thing. And the only reason I would say maybe they don't do that is if they want to do Super Nintendo Classic this year and they don't want to, you know, flood the market with too many of these things all at once.
Yeah, I mean, we could easily, in the next 5 minutes, we could easily fill up another 30 games on one of these things, no problem, especially if we're seeing, you know, the likes of Konami and Capcom are, you know, working with them on this stuff and allowing them to license the games. Like, there's so many great games on that console.
Yes. Yeah, Super Nintendo was interesting because so many more games were... based on licenses. And so actually, I think when you start looking at what Super Nintendo games are realistic for a SNES Classic, like what's actually possible and not based on a license they have to secure, you actually whittle down to about 30, 40, 50 games pretty fast. So, I mean, I think we can, if they say they're going to make one and they don't say what games, I think people would be able to guess pretty easily like what games would be on it just based on what's actually realistic.
Yeah, and it's sad because it's a sign. There's no, I mean, there's no, you know, Turtles Manhattan Project on this thing. So when people freak out when there's no Turtles in Time.
Those games, the Turtles games on the NES were not as important to NES culture, I think.
Oh, I just mean in terms of like the licensing, like if they weren't able to, you know, work that magic with Konami those guys.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like they wouldn't even bother trying to work that out just because, like, the Turtles games on NES, like, are not really going to get people excited. Maybe for Turtles in Time on Super NES, that being such a great game, like, maybe that would be where they would say, you know what, it's worth it for us to pay the extra money to make the licensing happen to get this game back out there again, just simply because that might be a really, really enticing proposition for people. Although I almost feel like they're not going to do it just because, quite frankly, there's so many great Super Nintendo games that they can put on without having the license and get themselves up to 30 games that I feel like they're not going to do it.
Well, we're talking a little bit about the state of retro right now, and I want to ask you about, because this is also going along with a huge increase, not just in the price of games in Japan when you go to, you know, those used game shops, but also here in the States, it's just getting astronomical. Like, I can't believe how, you know, year after year after year, you know, let's just like use the price of, you know, what, like Turtles in Time, since we're just talking about it, seeing it go from like $20 to $40 to $60 to $80 on eBay, like year after year, it's just making that jump. I'm curious, like, what are your thoughts? Again, that seems to just be fueled by nostalgia, fueled by people that, you know, have money to spend. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Well, look, we already saw this with Atari, and Atari has already had its peak. And I mean, quite frankly, people attempt to say, whenever I bring up Atari, people attempt to make these arguments that Nintendo is categorically different than Atari. Then comparing Nintendo and Atari is apples and oranges, for a variety of reasons. Like, you know, Atari, you know, barely really makes games anymore. The Nintendo games are still sold and they're still interesting. And these are things that do differentiate Nintendo from Atari. But I still honestly think the collector's market that we have with these things is roughly a similar situation with Atari. You had people in the early 90s, basically you had the first Atari collectors, and you had about a decade long period where prices just kept increasing for Atari, ColecoVision, Intellivision, because you got from the people when, you know, in the early 90s, the Atari collectors, these were crazy people. I mean, most of these games were worthless, and you could still buy like sealed 2600 games and sealed Intellivision, ColecoVision games for pennies, right? But then more and more people started getting into it. The dollar value started creeping up. And around 2004, really remember the 2004 Classic Gaming Expo was really interesting for me because, like, it was the biggest, I think, Classic Gaming Expo. G4 was there. You know, Howard Scott Warshaw was there. And, you know, G4 was taping footage. I remember taping footage of like Howard Scott Warshaw dancing down a dance floor at Classic Gaming Expo and using it in their shows. And Atari was all the rage, and all the Atari games at that show were so expensive. But that was the peak, because the Atari guys, the people who grew up with Atari, they were in their 30s, but now they were in their 40s, and they weren't really as interested anymore. And new people coming in. Now, the other thing that happened at the 2004 Classic Gaming Expo, it was where I met Frank Cifaldi offline for the first time. It was our first IRL meeting. And he was getting out of NES game collecting. He had all his Sachin games and stuff like that. And he was selling all of these like mint complete in box NES games for $5 each, and had very, very few takers. I bought a bunch of NES games from him. So I'm like, oh, I need Donkey Kong Classics. You know, I need Adventures of Lolo. Just beautiful mint copies for no money, because nobody cared. And then what happened was Atari went down. In general, Atari went down. And NES started coming up. And right now, I think we are plateauing on NES values. I don't really see a lot of NES games changing their values as much as they have in the years past. You know, Little Samson and Flintstones at Dinosaur Peak kind of topped out at $1,000-ish. Mm-hmm. You know, stadium events, we don't really have a whole lot of data recently, but like, a lot of games seem to be kind of hitting that plateau. And I mean, I think you understand now that like a lot of people right now, their nostalgia is it's the 90s kids that are turning 30. Mm-hmm. And it's the 80s kids that are turning 40 and maybe stopping caring so much about owning all those NES cartridges. I think people want to own Super Nintendo, which is why we're seeing all that kind of price explosion in and around Super Nintendo right now. And I think that NES will start to drop off. Now, people ask, is the bubble going to burst? We have to ask the question, to what extent is there a bubble? Because there's mm-hmm. no collecting. There's no collecting bubbles. Like, collecting is like, I'm collecting. Okay, now a couple other people are collecting. Now everybody's collecting. And it doesn't all just end. It drops off steadily, and the prices kind of go down steadily as more people get out and some people kind of cling on. The bubble is if you have a speculation bubble. Mm-hmm. And that is asking the question, to what extent are there people out there who are hoarding games, who are sitting on games purely because they're waiting for the price to go up as high as it can before they sell them? They're not really interested in owning the games. They believe that this is their retirement fund. They believe that there's a big payday waiting for them at the end of all of this. And if there's enough of those people out there to change the prices, the market prices, what happens is if prices start to go down, there is a rush by speculators to get out of the speculation market and sell off as fast as they can, which causes prices to go down further, further, further. And so that is what we have to be watching out for. But the question really is, how many people out there are actually speculating on stuff? And note that if you're a flipper, if you're a reseller, if you're somebody who buys and sells video games, you're not a speculator. And in fact, those people are not speculating. Those people are making money because they're constantly buying, selling, buying, selling, buying, selling, putting mm-hmm. money away. And they're not going to be affected by a bubble bursting because they're simply limited to whatever they have on hand at the time, and they're selling it. Actually, the people who really get affected by bubble bursting are people who actually think they're collectors but aren't. a lot of people lie to themselves and they say, "Oh, I'm a collector. I love video games." But then you'll be surprised, because some of those people, the second prices take a hit, they go crazy and they sell. And because they're so fundamentally opposed to selling. Because you have a lot of people who are speculating. There's a Venn diagram. Imagine the Venn diagram, okay? Mm-hmm. The people in the middle are people who get screwed the most when prices start to go down. The Venn diagram is people who yell online and complain online about resellers, quote unquote. And then the other half of the Venn diagram are people who won't admit to themselves that they're actually speculating on these old video games.
Right.
And the people in the middle of that are the people who, when the prices start to go down, are going to attempt to sell off everything before the prices go down even further. But because they're so like morally opposed to people who sell things, they don't have any experience in how do you sell things.
Right.
So they get hurt the absolute most because they want to be like, "Oh God, I got to sell my whole video game collection."
And hopefully that guy's like in your town and he's on Craigslist.
and you're able to go and pick up all that stuff. Well, that's what happens sometimes, because these things they go in waves. They go in waves. It's collecting kind of goes on this cycle. Like NES games will come back after they go down. Super Nintendo games will keep going higher, then they'll go down, et cetera, et cetera. N64, PlayStation's day is coming. You don't believe it, but PS2's day is coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
Later.
Well, what do you think? I mean, this is something that I didn't really realize until a couple months ago when I was just searching for something random online. But now I can't believe how rampant, not just like when we think repros, like I originally thought, okay, these are games that are either getting like a fan translation or you know, it's a game that never came out here in the States. Yep. And, you know, they're putting it, or it was a game like, you know, Star Fox 2 that never got a retail release. And that's available as a repro, a little bit of a gray area. But now, like, you search for games, you can look like directly on eBay, or Oddly enough, Etsy seems to be a really great place for people to go buy. Just here's a repro copy of Earthbound. Here's a repro copy of, you know, Sunset Riders for $20, $30. And do you think that's having an effect on the market as well?
Of course it's having an effect on the market, because there's, you know, it's introducing supply. It's introducing, now that supply is ultimately fake supply,
right.
But there are some people out there who just want, it's funny. So I'm generally opposed to all reproductions like this, unless there's like a really specific reason why you have to do it. For Star Fox 2, which is, it is one of the only reproduction games I own. I own a Star Fox 2 that somebody made. You cannot play Star Fox 2, I believe, on a Super Nintendo without, sadly, cannibalizing a previously existing Super FX game.
Exactly.
And so I do have one because I really wanted to get that experience of playing Star Fox 2 on a stock Super Nintendo. And I'm not necessarily even saying that this is a good idea, because if you cannibalize enough Super FX games, then those other Super FX games also become rare. Mm-hmm. So I'm conflicted in that sense. I'm not really conflicted when it comes to every other repro card. Again, whether or not it's a game that didn't come out here, an unreleased game anywhere, I'm not really conflicted, because I just think you shouldn't do it, because we're destroying the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there is nothing valuable, and I mean monetarily or even personally, you know, sentimentally, I think, valuable about a repro game that somebody made in his garage, because if you want to play it on a Super Nintendo, why give money to a bootlegger when you can just purchase an EverDrive, purchase an SD2 SNES or whatever,
totally,
a flash cartridge, and just put whatever ROMs you want on that flash card. Just do it that way. The repro thing is harmful, but then there's no benefit to it later at all.
Mm-hmm. That is an incredibly well thought out point. And I think that is like huge for people on the show to hear, because not like this is just getting even more and more rampant, and especially with the FX chip games. But you know, I thought, you know, way back like 2 or 3 years ago, that's not way back, but you know, 2-3 years ago, you know, a lot of these repro you know, manufacturers or people that were doing it, they're like, oh yeah, these are just Madden 96 carts. You know, that they're just
yeah.
But like again, when you're talking about doing Star Fox 2, you're talking about, you know, destroying, I mean, maybe even if it's Stunt Race FX or something, that's still destroying Stunt Race FX to make, you know, a Star Fox 2.
People, you know, again, people took copies of Action Comics number 1 and they wrapped up their leftover sandwich in it.
Yeah.
Cuz it's just a comic book.
Sure.
Really, we should not be destroying originals. Again, if you're making stuff that's just completely all original parts, sure, I guess you're not engaged in destruction, but you're also creating, I mean, the only difference between like a quote unquote, you know, collector's repro versus a counterfeit item is the seller, you know,
exactly,
what is the seller put in the listing? Because there's stuff out there. It's like, oh, it's just a repro. It's everybody knows it's a repro. It's okay. It's like, yeah, but what about in 100 years?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what about when you're basically just sort of clogging up this collector's market with things and making it more difficult for people. And it's not, yeah, I'm not a fan. I don't see the reason to do it. And I understand the psychology of it. Like, I mean, it is cool to, like, if I had like a Final Fantasy V, you know, Super Nintendo cartridge with the mm-hmm. fan translation on it. It's like to be able to hold it and imagine an alternate reality in which they actually did make a Super Nintendo version of it. Like that's, you know, I can see psychologically why you might be interested to own something like that. But the damage that these sorts of things are doing and will continue to do down the line is something that really gives me pause.
Well, you brought up a great point in your piece about the NES Classic Edition. It's like, you know, there is an opportunity and there is some precedent with Mother coming out on the NES with the Virtual Console on the Wii U, you know,
yeah.
for Nintendo to actually say, hey, we're going to open up the vault a little bit and allow you to get access to some of these games that for one reason or another, we just didn't release here. And even wasn't it like Final Fantasy, I guess it would have been Final Fantasy, I might be totally off base here, but Final Fantasy IV, didn't they actually like find the complete NES game? The version of the...
Oh,
I might be crazy.
With Final Fantasy II, which did not come out here, the NES version, the Famicom version, Square's original plan was they would release that game here as Final Fantasy II. And they actually got all the way through doing a first pass translation of it.
That's what I'm thinking, okay.
And then I think they realized that what basically happened was the 8-bit market collapsed,
mm-hmm.
And they realized they weren't going to be able to sell it. And so that's when they moved to Final Fantasy IV and they retitled it Final Fantasy II. But yeah, that was recently, you know, a few years ago discovered, not complete. The first pass translation was a little bit rough, but a completely translated, copy of Final Fantasy II. Would they include that on one of these things? Probably not. The translation is really rough. But there, I bet you there's stuff out there. I bet you there really is stuff out there like Mother, like Earthbound Beginnings, which was completely translated and done and just sitting around.
That's nuts.
For 2 decades until Nintendo was like, oh yeah, let's release this. It's like, oh yeah, thanks. You think?
Yeah, you have a couple stories like that in the book. I mean, it's the infamous story we just talked about at Star Fox 2, where they basically said, mm-hmm. like, yeah, we're just going to shelve all these 3D, you know, using the FX chip for 3D Super Nintendo games because yep. N64 is coming out. We got to make sure that people know that's where you get 3D.
Yes, and it's very similar to, you know, why Final Fantasy II didn't come out, why Earthbound mm-hmm. didn't come out. I mean, it's like, it's not that the game was bad. It's not that the game wasn't done. It's not that it wasn't a good game. It's that market conditions prevented them from releasing it, whether it was the collapse of the 8-bit cartridge market or the fact that Nintendo did not want to muddy the waters with a 3D game on the Super Famicom while N64 was coming out. And so, yeah, I mean, quite frankly, it would be wonderful if they put Star Fox 2. Star Fox 2 is, they finished it, you know. The version that's on the internet isn't finished. The version's on the internet, you can play through it, but...
Did they have it at like an event or something like that, or E3?
Yeah, they had it. Well, they had it at some event, but it wasn't done. And the version that's on the internet, like it was 99% complete and had some bugs and some problems. And then people basically fixed the bugs, just sort of patched it to get it going. And they translated it out of Japanese. But I bet you that there is because what Dylan Cuthbert said, who was the head of that project, was that they did finish the game. Like I kind of in a just in case kind of thing, like they had the developers complete the whole thing and then just did not release it. So like, if they do a SNES Classic and it supports Super FX games, that would be 100% something that they should include on there. Because A, it's a good game, and B, we don't even have the real finished version. I bet there's even an official English translation as well. But there's probably stuff we don't even know about. There's probably games that were finished and shelved that we're not even discussing because literally they never even got announced, that they could now, you know, be able to sell more NES classics by saying, oh, now with unreleased games.
Oh, man, we can only dream, I guess. People are going to kill us if we don't talk about some more Curry before we wrap up because...
Oh, yeah. So now that I've... Kevin, it's time to take your next step. Because
I was going to say, give me my guide for my next trip. I'm going back in April, so...
Oh, great. Okay, so now you live in Boston, is that
correct?
Right? Okay, so you can actually eat Gogo Curry whenever you want,
but
right?
I never do. I only eat it when I'm in Japan.
Do.
Isn't that I have a tentative lunch date with Corey Schmitz to go to Gogo Curry and to have him experience it and enjoy it. But I just feel like it's when I go to Tokyo.
Yeah. So here's the thing. Gogo Curry, as you know, is a very specific type of curry. I love Gogo Curry. It's great. But Japan is definitely like going through a little bit of a, you know, fun curry renaissance right now. Like curry is getting hot again.
All right.
And in fact, there's a couple of places that are incredibly convenient for you because they're right smack in the middle of Akihabara.
Perfect.
That are very different experiences. Very standard curry, but like it's the curry sauce is like
exactly.
it is as different from, you know, Gogo Curry and Kokoichi as they are. I mean, Kokoichi and Gogo Curry are very different from each other. Mm-hmm. And this is like third category. And so the place I'm sending everybody to right now, I mean, there's tons of great curry places out there, but the place I'm sending everybody to is called Hinoya, Hinoya Curry. Okay. It's a little, you know, the typical little curry stand. They won the grand prize for curry in 2013. Of course, there's a curry competition. And it's right near Super Potato. It's like you come out of Super Potato in Akihabara and you kind of walk almost, I think you almost walk straight or just around the corner. It's very, very close to there.
Okay.
And it is my current favorite. It is delicious. It's sweeter, but it has a really nice complex kind of flavor profile with lots of spicy elements. It's very, very good. And their thing is they will do, you don't have to get this, but they'll do a raw egg on top of it.
Nice.
And that works. If you like, you know, raw eggs on your, you know, ramen or whatever kind of thing, you know, like this is a great experience. It kind of melts all into the curry. It's delicious. So Hinoya, there's a place called Johto Curry, which is actually, it's like right, it's on the main street in Akihabara. It's mm-hmm. it's very hard to miss. It's near the Carl's Jr. because now there's a Carl's Jr. in Akihabara. and that place is also excellent as well. And when you go, have you been to the Super Potato in Ikebukuro?
No.
You need to go to this because so there's an entire second awesome Super Potato and it's in Ikebukuro, which is now the Ikebukuro is now like Akihabara 2, basically.
No
like
way.
I'm a nerd area.
That's yeah. where I do like I go there for teaching for what I do or teaching in my field. And like I spend 2 days in Ikebukuro when I'm there. So I must have completely missed it.
it's very easy to miss, but there is a Super Potato there. It's really close to the Sunshine City Mall, you know.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Really near the big book off that they have there. Yeah, there's Super Potato. It's massive, and actually it's less picked over than Akihabara because fewer people go there.
No way. All right.
And right across from this and this Super Potato is it's a place called Moyan Curry, Moyan.
Okay.
And their deal is I don't want to get you too excited because I know you got many months before you go there. Their deal is they do a lunch buffet.
Oh geez.
I just want you to imagine gigantic tureens of the most of delicious Japanese curry, as much as you want to eat. It's pretty great.
That sounds pretty good. Oh man, you gotta
roll yourself over to Super Potato afterwards.
Well, I'm always amazed by like I can eat. But like you'll go and like, you know, again, just using Gogo Curry as an example, you'll go and you'll sit down and you will just see the smallest Japanese people eat
yes.
the most gigantic portions of food and then get a second portion and they just
hang out.
Not even, they won't be on their phone. They'll just look at their food. They'll just eat for like half an hour straight. It's unbelievable.
They eat. Yeah. The some of the biggest food I've ever seen in my life is in Japan. I mean, it's all about like, like even like Burger King will do like, oh, it's a Whopper with four patties or something like that. It's like, what the heck, people?
And they give us crap for gigantic portion sizes. But if you look, like they're doing a big time in Japan. It's king size.
I think maybe they only do it once a week or something like that. Whereas for us, it's every day.
Wow. All right. So I'm going to go on somewhat of a mission next time I go out to Japan and just make sure I continue to pace myself because those are three curry places I got to go to.
I try to break people out of their curry ruts because it used to be, I mean, again, like 10, it's funny because like it's sort of the curry thing sort of mirrors the, you know, I was writing about Japanese video games 10 years ago and things are totally different, but the curry situation too, it was just like back in when I was going to Tokyo Game Show in like 2005, I was literally telling all the Americans I knew like, oh, let's go get curry. Let's go get Japanese curry. And they're like, what's Japanese curry? I don't like curry. And it's like, oh my God, you're stupid. And we'd go. And then I slowly kind of Johnny Appleseeded, you know, getting everybody into the idea of going to Kokoichi and then Gogo Curry and whatever. But now my mission is really whenever I go, I just try to eat as many different curry places that I haven't eaten at before as I can, that I can try to expand my knowledge of, like, of other places that are out there that people should go to, because there's just there's too much delicious curry, and I try to pass that on. So
you're doing God's work, and I will make sure I go there. I will report back, and you know, for people like you mentioned in the States, you know, also they're blowing up in New York. There's a bunch of locations in New York now.
Yep.
But Boston area, and I believe, is there still one out in like L.A. or San Francisco?
Go-Go Curry, no, but Los Angeles has a bunch of Coco Ichibanya.
Okay. Yeah,
yep.
Okay.
Yep. And nothing in the San Francisco Bay Area. Well, there's curry places, and there are very good curry places here, but there's no authentic Japanese chains. There's no Coco or Go-Go, so we'll
you
see.
Would think that would be the market for it.
I think that the first, whoever the first penguin is who jumps off the ice floe into the water and actually opens up, like, a whether it's Go-Go Curry or Coco Ichibanya here, like, they will probably be shocked at the reaction. I mean, geez, it's San Francisco. Like, this is foodie town right here. And so hopefully that will actually happen, and it will sort of inspire a boom, and there'll be more places as well, because I think that both would do incredibly well here.
Well, hopefully you guys aren't too hungry to not first jump on Amazon and go pick up Power Up, because it's like I said, it's, you know, $10 and for if, like, literally, if you're listening to this episode, if you're listening to this podcast, you are the person that is going to appreciate this material the most. So I really hope you go and check it out. And, you know, like you said, it's also on Kindle. If you're just so against paper, you can get it on your phone, your laptop, your actual Kindle, whatever you read books on. And of course, Chris is not only at Wired.com, but also Good Job Brain, which has just incredibly been, you know, blowing up, winning awards. And congratulations with all the success with that, which people can also pick up on your favorite podcast application or wherever you get podcasts, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much.
And a new book, right?
And we have a book on that, too. Yeah, I wasn't supposed to release, like, two books on the same day. It wasn't supposed to work out that way, but
it happens.
But we did. Yes, so we all wrote, it's a book of trivia. We're the concept behind the podcast is we're a pub trivia team, so we get together, we bring in facts and, you know, stories, and we quiz each other, and we all try to get better at pub trivia that way, and try to help people do the same thing. It's very not video game related in any way, but we do try to be entertaining. We have a book for that as well. But the podcast is free. So, I mean, I would say I would go for the free thing first.
Totally.
And see if you like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you do, the book is also under $10, so it's not like you're going to be breaking the bank. That's less than the price of curry, and you'll have, you know, plenty of money over, left over for curry as well. But
left over for curry, exactly.
Oh man, I'm so hungry right now. I'm like, I'm thinking maybe
sorry.
I'm just going to drive out there.
You should. You're so close. I'd eat there every day if I live. Anyway.
Okay. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Chris, thank you so much. It's been a huge pleasure to chat. And just, again, it's fun to pick your brain on a lot of this stuff and to finally, you know, Skype meet. And I cannot wait to, you know, see what people think of the book and to see what else is coming down the road for you. But is there anything else that people should keep an eye out for that you're working on or anything like that?
Nope.
Perfect.
I'm working on stuff. If you want to find out what it is I'm doing or find links to any of this stuff, my Twitter handle is a weird handle. It's a Kobunheat, Kobunheat. So if you want to find me on Twitter, that's where I am. Or to search for Chris Kohler, although there are other Chris Kohlers. Mm. There's actual journalist Chris Kohler who report on business. There's gay porn star Chris Kohler. So don't
awesome.
Follow or do follow him.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, follow whoever you want. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's the internet. Internet is great and, you know, sometimes terrible, but usually fantastic. So, you know, again, go check out all that stuff. Hopefully you guys are able to, you know, pick up the book, pick up an NES Classic Edition, and go pick up some curry and just have an outstanding week, because it is. Oh, and that's the last thing I want to mention. We mentioned EverJives real quick. And before I forget, those are actually going to be going on sale on Black Friday.
Yes.
So, if you listen to this, I'm actually going to release this on Tuesday. So you'll have a couple days to prep. Those are going to go on sale on the 25th, and the website is krikzz.com, and you can get an EverDrive and experience those.
And
Yeah, go ahead.
And I will say, I did last year for the Black Friday sale. I did. The guy's in like the Ukraine, I think, yep. And it was. It's sort of like it's like this e-commerce site, and it's like, it's should I be doing this? It's a little bit weird. It's not anything like, and it's like, how long is it going to take? No, I got my devices, you know, fairly shortly. I got them before the end of the year. They work great. I love it. So I independently endorse buying from this guy. But I would say, before Black Friday rolls around, because they will, some
They'll
will start
gone.
To sell
yeah.
out. Go do your research, because there's many different models of like a Super Nintendo flash cartridge. There's many different models, so do the research on what do they support. You know, what kind of ROMs will they run? Like how big? Whatever. Like do that research first, so you know exactly what you want to buy when you go in.
Great call. Go check all that stuff out. You guys have a lot of homework to do, and I'm going to start booking my flights to Japan and my Google Map trip to Curry Heaven.
Right.
So until next time, again, thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see you in about a week. Take care.